Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist, Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani says he's not running against Daniel Patrick Moynihan for the United States Senate. And that leaves the Republican Party without a big-name front-running candidate. Although it's not affecting anyone running for office just yet, the 1990 census is in the planning stages, and that may mean radical changes for the New York delegation in Congress. We'll look at allegations that the state legislators have conflicts of interest with a major bank, and we'll talk to one man who is charged with having this conflict. All these stories and more coming up on this week's Legislative Gazette. Republican U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani says he's ending speculation about his bid for the Senate seat currently occupied by Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And that's creating a bit of a problem for the Republican Party. Paul Rosenthal has more.
The 43-year-old Giuliani has garnered a nationwide reputation for his aggressive prosecution of big city corruption, organized crime, and Wall Street criminality. He's been mentioned frequently as a potential candidate for city or state office, and until recently, Giuliani has repeatedly delayed announcing his plans or whether he even had any firm plans to run for public office. One of Giuliani's reasons for not running for the Senate seat was because he was concerned about his successor. Giuliani said he wanted a prosecutor familiar with the current cases to complete them, and he wasn't sure that would happen. But U.S. Senator Alphonse D'Amato, a colleague and the man who would have recommended Giuliani's successor in the prosecutor's job, said he's not to be blamed for Giuliani's decision. D'Amato says he gave Giuliani veto power over the special prosecutor recommendation. The feud still continues, but in the meantime, Ed Lurie, executive director of the New York State Republican Party, says they now have to find another candidate who is committed to running against Senator Moynihan.
We will continue to talk to candidates, Tony Calavita, the state chairman, will be meeting with county chairman within the next month to talk about the Senate, and we'll be talking to candidates, and hopefully very shortly we'll be coming out with a candidate that has already committed being a candidate rather than speculating in the press.
Although Lurie and D'Amato are not pleased with Giuliani's decision, one person who is happy about that announcement is Governor Cuomo.
Rudy Giuliani's decision is good for the Democrats. It's good for the state of New York because it keeps him prosecuting for a while longer. And it's good for Pat Moynihan. It's bad for Republicans and felons.
Do you see a time that in the foreseeable future when you see Rudy Giuliani running for a particular office?
I encouraged him to keep his interest in politics.
How did it come about that you spoke to him? Did you reach out to him, as you say, or did
he's? We've developed a good, strong relationship. I'm an admirer of his. I don't agree with his politics, but he's been a strong prosecutor and an effective one. He's an Italian American, doing law enforcement. That makes him an especially useful symbol for a people who are still, to some extent, burdened with the stereotype of the organized criminal, etc.
In his more than 4 years in office, U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani has personally prosecuted former Bronx Democratic leader Stanley Friedman and others charged with corruption of the New York City Parking Violations Bureau. His office has also won long prison terms for three organized crime family bosses who sat on the mafia's ruling commission. But possibly Giuliani's most famous case was the admission of insider trading by millionaire stock manipulator Ivan Boesky of Westchester County, whose cooperation has led to several guilty pleas and investigations of other financial district leaders. The question now remains if the Republican Party can find another candidate for Senate who has the public reputation that Giuliani has established. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Paul Rosenthal.
There's been another new development with regard to New York's politicians and their conflict of interest problems. Fred Dicker, Capital Bureau Chief of the New York Post, discovered that many of the law firms who handle business for Citibank are politically connected, and many of these firms have partners who are senior officials in the state legislature. Fred spoke to Dave Gillette about these findings.
They were reporting today that Citibank, the nation's largest bank, has been steering hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees to the law firms of the top decision makers at the legislature. And these are the decision makers, elected officials and appointed ones, who control the outcome of all the proposed new state laws affecting Citibank. And Citibank is actively lobbying now to have some of those laws changed. Amongst the law firms that are receiving Citibank money are firms which have as members Assembly Speaker Melvin Miller, Ken Shapiro, who's Miller's chief assembly counsel, Jay Adolph, who's Miller's law partner and a deputy counsel handling banking matters, and on the Senate side, Senate Banking Committee Chairman Ralph Marino, and John Hagerty, who's Senate Majority Leader Warren Anderson's chief attorney and a deputy to Hagerty. Now, Citibank, when I confronted them with my information, responded that it was true, but pointed out or claimed that, in fact, these lawmakers and these top officials have actually been soliciting Citibank for the business. So we have a situation where people who can conceivably control all of Citibank's legislation have been going, Citibank claims, to Citibank saying, give us some of your business.
Now, in that regard, didn't Citibank think that there was something wrong?
They didn't say. They claim that the appointments of these law firms, their selection to do this business, has nothing to do with politics. But it's very difficult for us to believe because we have a list of the firms that they've selected. And for instance, two out of four firms that they use in the entire county of the Bronx are politically connected. Two out of four firms that they use in all of Queens, New York are politically connected. It seems very difficult for us to believe that this is merely by accident.
What are the magnitude of these payments?
Well, Citibank last year, by its own admission, sold about $4.6 billion in residential properties in the greater New York City area. Lawyers familiar with the implications of that have estimated that between $8 to $10 million in mortgage closing fees were paid out by the bank, and it's through these mortgage closing fees, the apportionment of them, that the law firms that are connected to the politicians have been getting money.
Do you have any evidence that other banks may be doing things similar?
No, it was tough enough to get this evidence, David, but one of the things we plan to do today is ask some of the other major banks in the state to provide us with a list of the attorneys who handle their mortgage, their real estate mortgage closings.
Now, that is not information that would be readily available, is it?
It is not. It's proprietary, private. We were fortunate enough to have a document from Citibank leaked to us, and that enabled us to write this story.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post. One lawmaker named in the Citibank conflict of interest story was Assemblyman Vincent Leibel, a Republican of Putnam County. I spoke with Assemblyman Leibel about some legislative changes he's proposing and about the Citibank conflict of interest problem.
Assemblyman Stephen Saland from Poughkeepsie and myself and Senator Chris Maga from New York City are sponsors of a bill that would limit, if adopted, it's a constitutional amendment, it would limit the terms for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, controller, to 2 4-year terms. The legislation also goes beyond that, however, to say that members of the state legislature would serve 4-year terms instead of the present 2-year terms, but there would be a limit of 16 years. In other words, 4 4-year terms.
Why 4 for them and 2 for the statewide officers?
Well, no, in other words, that the idea being that because the executive branch and the legislative branch have different responsibilities, and traditionally the legislative branch has served much longer periods of time. As you're aware, you've had members here have served well in excess of 30 years in the New York State Legislature. To give some continuity, and also because the responsibilities are different, it seemed more workable to make the legislature longer. You have never seen a governor who stayed in 30 years, but you have seen many members of the state legislature.
Right. Okay. What are you trying to correct? What's the idea here?
I'm hoping that it'll do a couple of things. One thing, I believe very strongly that there is a constant need for new blood and new ideas to be coming into the legislative process. I think that this is possibly one method of doing this. We have also seen over the years that whether the United States Congress or the New York State Legislature, the fact that someone of either party is an incumbent, there has been a tremendous rate of return in terms of reelecting incumbents, in excess of 98% for both the Congress and the New York State Legislature. The idea here being that in an age of media, just as now, I am getting my name recognition increased by your asking me these questions on your radio station. That's an advantage for me over a potential challenger. And in an age of media, there's probably very few things that can be done to address that, because you have to get your message out and the fact that you are doing certain things. One thing we can do, though, is to limit the number of terms that members of the legislature will serve. It will guarantee that there will be a constant turnover, especially, most importantly, in the top leadership ranks.
And in doing this, I take it, you would like to keep a full-time citizen, so-called citizen legislature, as opposed to a more professional legislature that does nothing else.
Well, I think a citizen legislature can be completely professional. What I don't want to see is a civil service legislature. I don't want to see the situation where people are elected here and almost entirely spend their entire careers in the legislative process. I think that's a very great danger. I think it removes the legislator from dealing with the average citizen, their constituents, and will, in my opinion, lead to great disaster for the state of New York.
Okay, now, Assemblyman, one of the things that has been happening in the legislature, we're reading more and more about it now, is the potential for conflict of interest.
Right.
That is to say that somebody, because he's an assemblyman or senator and also a lawyer, gets an awful lot of law business or insurance business or real estate business, because people essentially are coming to them knowing full well, if they give them the business, that maybe somehow their clients will get a better shake, or that they'll get a better shake before the legislature. Some see it as an almost legal form of not bribery, but inducement.
Well, let me put it this way. And I'm an attorney. In any profession you serve in, and the reason professions have higher standards, supposedly, you always have the potential for conflict. You have that as a news reporter working for a radio station. Who pays for your advertising time? Look at your print media, where the millions and millions of dollars are spent by the tobacco industry, and yet they're still frequently called upon to write editorials that could possibly chastise the cigarette and tobacco industry. You always have the potential in a profession, whether you're a doctor, lawyer, priest, newsman, to have a conflict of interest. The key is to recognize the potential to make sure that it doesn't affect your ultimate decision-making. That's the key.
But now we have stories running in newspapers showing that, for example, some of our key decision-makers have relationships with things like Citibank, places like that, in which they have, which Citibank has a legislation that will appear before the legislature. And they are saying that, okay, your firm or somebody else's firm can be on that list and can be approved. And some people think that that makes it very easy for Citibank to then come back before the legislature.
Well, I don't think that necessarily is so, not just in terms of a bank, but anyone else. There may be some things that are so obviously close that there would be a conflict of interest. But there are many, many times when you will, as an attorney, say, represent somebody, and it doesn't necessarily impact on you in your other area of life. For instance, if you had a doctor here who was a member of the legislature, would that mean that that person could not perform surgery on a Citibank official? Or have a relationship as a doctor? We've had clergymen who have served here. Would that rule out their acting in their profession? I don't think so. I believe, though, it is something you will always want to be careful for, to make sure that it doesn't influence your decision-making, and I think that's a professional decision. I think the potential for conflicts has gone back to the Revolutionary War, but nonetheless, it's something that you always have to be careful for. If someone is, in fact, selling a vote, that's a crime, and there are laws on the books that deal with that.
Very hard
the
to fact prove that.
No, let me say this. The fact that what we're talking about now is a public knowledge rules out to a large extent the possibility of there being a conflict there.
But some law firms, obviously, Assemblyman, you can't deny this. Some law firms get that business and some don't. And the fact that they've been designated on a list by the Citibank just has to help them. And certainly it's got the perception of conflict when Citibank then pushes for banking changes before these very same people.
I think the only I have to say, I think the only reason there's a perception there is because the New York Post did it in its usual National Enquirer style.
Well, the Associated Press did it also. A lot of people picked up on that.
They picked
story.
Up on it. And let me put it this way. This is one of my concerns in terms of what we're talking about. You can create any sort of an aura that you want, that there is the wrongdoing or the potential for wrongdoing out there. One of the most interesting things about the ethics legislation that was passed last year
right.
is the fact that it will provide for insulation now. In other words, members of the legislature who are here as either attorneys or in other businesses will be able to insulate themselves because they will not be able to receive income from areas where there are clear conflicts.
Republican Assemblyman Vincent Libell. The 1990 census is just around the corner, and the population changes for this decade means New York may lose up to 3 congressional seats. Brenda McMahon has this story.
The New York State Legislature is looking into procedures to get an accurate account of the state's population for the 1990 census. Lawmakers are concerned about the census because the state's population has decreased significantly, and that means fewer congressional seats and maybe even a loss of a state Senate seat. Louis Hoppe, co-executive director of the Legislative Task Force on Demographic Research and Reapportionment, explains the importance of the census.
The results of the 1990 census are used to determine the number of members each state will have in Congress. It's also used to determine, therefore, the number of electoral votes each state has for the election of president and vice president. And obviously that's quite important, its representation in Washington. It's also used to determine the distribution of state legislative seats around the state. So if an area grows, it gets more representation, and if it loses population, it gets less. Equally important, it's also a money item because there are many federal programs that are determined how much each state gets by the census.
Hoppe says although the changes in congressional seats are not definitive, it looks as though New York will lose up to 3 votes in Washington.
The best guess, and it's just a guess, at this point is that the state of New York will lose 3 members of Congress. We're not going to lose any members of the state legislature because that stays the same. But we will lose 3 members of Congress in the state. Where they will be is even more of a guess than the number. The biggest population loss in the state has been in the western end of the state. The Buffalo, Niagara Falls, Jamestown area has had the biggest population loss.
Although the population decreases have been in western New York and the South Bronx, Hoppe says this doesn't necessarily mean those representatives will lose their seats. And as for any changes in the state legislature, he says the Senate may see some changes, but they'll be minimal.
Will be 150 assembly seats. The number of seats in the state Senate may change. 150 in the state assembly is set in the state constitution. That will never change until the constitution is amended. The state Senate can change. It's a formula in the state constitution instead of a set number. Application of that formula to the 1970 census created 60 districts. To the 1980 census, the formula created 61 districts. So you can see even if there is a change, it'll probably be minuscule.
The 1990 census won't affect the state legislature as much as it affects Congress, but 2 years after the census comes statewide reapportionment, when all the Senate and Assembly district lines are redrawn due to population changes. This is important because state politicians can't anticipate how their districts will change and how that change will affect their reelection bids. But in addition to the change in the state's political standing, the 1990 census also decides how much federal and state monies localities will get. Hoppe says for the 1980 census, for example, New York City discovered that 23% of its budget came from state and federal monies. This includes funding for education, transportation, and homelessness. Those are just a few of the reasons why the state legislature is trying to get the most accurate account of all the residents in New York for the 1990 census. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Brenda McMahon.
Against the seven, I think of nothing, living in darkness, and the diamond lady.
Just what to do about education is on the minds of many important people these days. With controversies in the news concerning several members of the Board of Regents, I took the opportunity to speak with Assemblyman Jose Serrano, Chairman of the Assembly Education Committee, about some of these issues.
Well,
Well, there's a lot of things that are taking place at once. People are discussing the restructuring of the New York City school system, which is key to the whole educational picture in New York State. Secondly, there is a consideration going on right now for the re-election or creating vacancies in four region seats throughout the state. In addition, there is a fifth seat, which is vacant by the virtue of the fact that a member of the regents was elected to the another political position. So the regents, the budget, the restructuring of New York City are issues that are being discussed all at once, and this promises to be a session that discusses those issues more so than in the past.
Joe, are you satisfied with the way in which the regents are behaving?
No, in general, I have not been satisfied, and I have publicly stated that. I feel that in the past, the regions, first of all, did not serve the whole state. In other words, they sort of kept their hands off the largest school district in the state, which is the New York City district. And I mention that because whether you live in New York City or not, what happens to New York City school children should be your concern, either from a humane point of view or simply as a taxpayer. If children in the largest school district in the state with 966,000 students keep dropping out at rates of anywhere from 55 to 72%, then eventually you're going to have to build jail cells, you're going to have to increase your social services roles, you're going to have to deal with more crime because that's what happens to a lot of children that drop out of school. So I was always concerned that they never paid attention to that city and sort of kept their hands off and let the local school district there do whatever it wanted. Secondly, in many cases we were concerned that the region sounded very much like a group of people who would sit around and work on their philosophy all day and never really put on roll up their sleeves and put a get a hands-on situation on the problems that existed. In the last couple of years, if nothing else, that message has been brought home to them. I believe that some of the members who've come up for re-election in the last few years and have been re-elected are beginning to do a turnaround and address these issues. These new folks or these ones that are coming now for re-election or for reconsideration will hear that message, and no matter what the end result will be, whoever gets elected as regents will have it clear in their mind that the legislators are concerned about what happens in schools.
Now, Joe, let's be fair about this. We hear over and over again the word elected regents, but we all know the big secret is that the Assembly, which has more members than the Senate, and since they get together to elect the regents, the Assembly really does the electing. And we know something else. We know that the chairman of the Education Committee probably has more power in electing a regent than anybody else. So you really get to appoint these regents, don't you?
Well, I would like to sound like a big shot on your program and tell you that I do. But the fact of the matter is that regents are selected with many considerations in mind, and in all honesty, one of them is the regional consideration. In other words, regents are selected or elected from judicial districts.
That gives you a lot of power, right?
Well, it does to a certain extent, but I tell you the truth, I would not simply select a region and push it down anybody's throat.
Sure,
that delegation has to be comfortable with that region.
One of your hottest potatoes this year has been a regent named Dr. Adelaide Sanford, who is alleged by the Albany Times Union, who was there, a reporter named Tim Spofford, to have said that white children were not on her agenda, that that she was more interested in minority children. That was viewed as a very tough thing, and you were asked how you felt about it. How do you feel now?
Well, I still feel the same way. I have tried to reach her and have not been successful at doing it. It's just a matter of phone calls going through. But I'm hoping that she can show me that she never said that, because if she did, that would be a very unfortunate statement, since I believe that my role, and certainly the role of a regent, is to treat every child alike and to service every child in the state of New York. What we don't need now more than ever is any kind of a statement that would divide students along racial or ethnic lines. If there's a child in Utica who is white but is not performing well in school, then that child is my concern, just as there is a child in Brooklyn whom I need my help.
Joe, there have been people who have called for her impeachment. How do you get rid of a regent if they do a terrible thing? Can you impeach them?
You know, you're asking the $1 million question. There are people now looking at the law only because this question has been brought up, and some very smart lawyers have not come up yet with any
any clear language that says how you get rid of a regent, except not to re-elect him.
We have a brand new education commissioner this year. How's he doing?
You know, I'm very impressed with Commissioner Sopel. I must honestly tell you that at the beginning, I was concerned that he didn't have urban experience. But I see him doing two things which I like. First of all, he's visiting everyone. He's talking. He's admitting that he has a lot to learn. He's asking questions of people. He's not ashamed as commissioner to say to a legislator, what should I be doing about this particular problem? And then from there, formulate his ideas. And the second thing I like, in regards to what I had told you about the regents earlier, is that he's decentralizing some of the resources and services here in Albany and telling these folks and directing these resources to try to solve and deal with the problems of New York City. And he feels that some of those problems are better dealt with by having people work in the city rather than to work in Albany. And I like that idea.
Assemblyman Jose Serrano is the chairman of the Assembly Education Committee. And that's it for this week's Legislative Gazette. The show is produced by Brenda McMahon. She had help this week from Paul Rosenthal, Bruce Robertson, and Dave Galletly. We hope you enjoyed the show, that you'll tune in again next week to hear what's happening in and around the Empire State. Until then, I'm Alan Chartok, reminding you to support public radio.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the Legislative Gazette, a weekly newspaper on state politics, with student internships available.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.